listeners to Sounding Out's podcast series, an oral chronicle of sounding culture. Sounding Out remixes the everyday with theory, insight, and practice. To learn more, please visit us on the web at www.soundstudiesblog.com. Until then, stay tuned for today's episode.
From the very beginning of colonization in North America, Eurocentric ideologies overwhelmingly have failed to recognize the strengths of American Indian cultures. Government-supported education, among other things, became the means to accomplish the forced eradication of indigenous language. For many tribes, their language is completely gone. For others, it is still there. Native communities right now are fighting hard to keep languages alive. The spoken language is our oral history. It is a cherished intellectual treasure. Each sound captures how we see the world. For this talk today, we have the unique perspective of three Native women. Each are artists, mothers, they're educators and scholars, active in their Native community, and they are language learners and speakers. How are we, as Native people, searching for the sounds? And what does that mean to us? This conversation about Native language is not about the more common science of linguistics. It's not about history or methods of specific language preservation efforts. It is a conversation about an experience of listening and trying to find our sound again. Right now, I'm going to have the three participants go ahead and introduce themselves so we can begin our conversation.
Hi, my name is Rachel Nez, and I'm from the Navajo Nation, and one of my passions is strengthening Native languages by way of technology.
And Rochelle.
Shojuit Rochelle Adams Oji, Guchajit Atsendu Guatanisi. In cultural enrichment specialist in jijuk egihi gogol e ta gechwa tanisi jukjat chitri sa shronch I gehan nisa garinhi jukjin gweheza masicho marcella and jet shukutrit tukwas in. My name is Rochelle Adams. I'm from the villages of Fort Yukon and Beaver. And now I live here in Anchorage, where I'm a cultural enrichment specialist. And I'm a language learner and also a language teacher. And I said that my heart is really happy today because I get to speak with you about these good things for our language. And I wanted to thank Marcella for having me join in today. And Jukdrin Gwehezia, and things are going to be good. So thank you. And I do a lot of work in the language. I work in my own home communities with the elders and the youth. That's where I get a lot of my guidance. I work on a statewide level in Alaska towards revitalization for all of 20 of our languages, including all dialects. I'm a grad student working towards my master's in applied linguistics, and I'm in a program called the CALL program with UAF's Alaska Native Language Center, and it's a computer-assisted language learning. So we're actually working on, how do we teach using technology, especially in Alaska, because a lot of our villages are so isolated. So we're working using technology to connect people, like learners with speakers. that's a bit of what I've been doing lately.
Okay. My name is Dondi Williams Davis. I am a member of the Shoshone-Bannock Tribes of Fort Hall, Idaho. I am currently a student at the University of Idaho. I was working on a PhD in environmental science. However, I was recently accepted into a National Science Foundation program called IGERT, which is requiring that I move programs. So I'm going to be a student in the Water Resources program. I did my master's from the University of Arizona, and I focused on preservation and sustainability of the peyote cactus. And I, like Rochelle, am very happy to be here. I'm excited to talk about language and how language has changed, how it's evolving, and all of those things. I grew up in a Shoshone-speaking household. I was raised by my maternal grandparents, and they both spoke fluent Shoshone. And so I myself am not a fluent speaker, but I wish I was. But that's a part of the growth of our nation, is that we're slowly moving away from that, and eventually we're trying to come back to that. So eventually I would like to learn more of the Shoshone language. Okay.
Great. And Rachel, when you introduced yourself, it was a little briefer, but talk about a little bit about your language experience. Did you, like Dondi, did you grow up in a language home? Are you self-taught?
Yes, my first language was Navajo. My second language is English. And then I started going to school. And then English became my dominant language. My mother speaks Navajo. My father speaks Navajo. I was always immersed in Navajo. But the more education I got, the less Navajo I spoke. So currently, I would consider myself Navajo being my second language. It's very important for me to keep that language and teach that language, especially now that I have a daughter. It's very important for me to teach her the language. And I think one of the difficulties that I run into is how. I live in California, so away from the reservation and away from language speakers, and it's really hard to do, because you have conversations basically with yourself in Navajo, and I do understand that she's learning a lot of these sounds, but you get to that point where you're just like, let's just talk in English now. So those are some of the difficulties that I run into, and again, learning my language and continuing to keep it strong is very important. I think just being away from the reservation is a difficult part.
So there's interesting things going on in just that. So if in your generation it's not, or in all of our generations, I guess, it's not very common to have our native tongue or our native languages be the first language. Would you guys all agree with that?
Shoshone was probably my first language as well. You know, growing up with my grandparents, that's the language that they taught us. And, you know, it was an English Shoshone speaking home, but the dominant language, I would say, when I was younger was Shoshone. And so, you know, we don't speak Shoshone here in our own home, but I find that when I am around my grandparents or I'm at my grandparents' home, I find that I say a lot more things in Shoshone than I do when I'm at my own home.
So if we're talking about sound, and the sound of your grandparents' home is very different than the sound of your own home.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. And when would you say you started to lose those sounds, and that sound, I mean, the language, if you're a child and that's what you're speaking, was there a point in your life where that started to change?
Oh yeah, I would definitely say for me, it happened right at kindergarten. I mean, I went to Head Start programs on the reservation, and that's what we learned our body parts in Shoshone. And, you know, we learned Shoshone songs, but the minute I went to kindergarten and I was no longer around other Indian kids, that's when I was like, I wanted to speak English. You know, that's all I wanted. I mean, that's all I knew, but I also knew Shoshone, but I definitely wanted all English language speaking all the time.
Hmm. How about yourself, Rochelle?
Well, I think my parents are a little kind of young. And so my grandparents spoke, actually my grandfathers on both my mom and my dad's on both sides. They spoke, but they passed away when I was very young. And my parents are passive speakers. They have passive knowledge of the language. They can understand it, but they can't really speak it. So they can't, you know, produce output, but they can understand. So I was around the sounds when I was little, you know, with my grandparents, great-grandparents, but it wasn't necessarily spoken in my household where I grew up. But I've always had that desire, and I've always wanted to learn. And so it wasn't until later in life that I began learning more. Because when I was younger, you know, like we had bilingual programs, but, you know, they didn't have the best teaching methods in school. And so it was a lot of like vocabulary and not teaching those in context. And so I wasn't able to put sentences together or make, you know, be able to use the lone vocabulary words that I was learning. So it wasn't until later that when I really started learning that I was able to kind of put those things that I had learned when I was younger, put them together, and then they started making sense. So I wasn't really around it, I mean, in my home. So I think that our language shift, you know, up here in Alaska is, I mean, it's similar to down there, but we have the, you know, the generational thing. But there's not really anyone my age that I can speak to. And so I speak a lot to elders, and I spend a lot of time in the archives listening. And so that's the way I hear the sounds through. It's not like a two-sided conversation. A lot of times it's me listening to elders or listening to old stories. And so that way I'm trying to find, you know, as many ways as I can to make that, to create that space where it's a two-way conversation, especially with my peers that are my age or younger. So I really try, you know, to continue that, because, you know, all of our languages are so severely endangered. There's not many speakers left. So yeah, it's a challenge. And, you know, I wish there were more speakers, but that's why there's such a big push for the revitalization up here. Mm-hmm.
And I think probably everywhere, right, Rachel? You've worked with a lot of tribes all over the U.S. and Canada. Mm-hmm. And what's the status of language in your experience working with so many tribes and with technology and language?
I worked with a nonprofit program called the Indigenous Language Institute, and that afforded me the opportunity to kind of see what other communities were doing in regards to language preservation and revitalization. And every community was different. Every community, their concerns overall were how to keep their languages alive. But again, like I said, every community was different. For example, we worked with a Comanche elder who was probably in about her 80s, very strong advocate for strengthening or keeping the Comanche language alive. And then when I asked her how many language speakers there are for the Comanche, she said that there was 8. And this was about 3 years ago. Mm. So within that community, you have 8, you know, fluent language speakers left. That was interesting. And then we went to the Mississippi Choctaw, and they are publishing books in their language. They are really involved in education and then bringing the language into the education system. And in the classrooms that I taught there was, you know, 30, 40 speakers that spoke in their language, which was really interesting to see. And you travel to the Navajo Nation, and they have an immersion school, which is, you know, another interesting thing to see, because it's like a
K through 8, and it's a two-story building, and they're teaching the Navajo language to these children there. So it was very different in all areas. But the bottom line was, you know, they were really trying to work towards the various different ways to keep their language alive, whether it be bi-total, or I believe it's a method they use, total physical response. Much like Rochelle was saying, how we are listeners of the language and we understand the language, but actually outputting it, like she was saying, is something that I've run across a lot in a lot of tribes, is that we are hearers but not speakers.
So TPR is kind of like, it's total physical response. So it's like using your body. Like if you're telling the students to stand up, then you stand up, you know, or like you sit down. You're basically showing them through your movements what you're talking about. Hmm. And it's good because you don't have to directly translate everything into English. And there's more retention because you're actually using, you know, your whole body and using the modalities that kind of stick with people, you know, because not everyone, you know, everyone learns different. Not everyone learns by just reading or writing. So if you're actually acting out, you know, what you're doing, there's more retention with that. So.
But TPR is really interesting to me because that's literally moving your body with the sounds to retain it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
Okay. Yeah, well, they say it's like kinesthetic, brain-based, you know, language teaching. So so that's why there's more retention. You know, you're actually like moving and doing it, you know, as opposed to like sitting there and being more like a passive learner.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, Dondi, because we have Rachel and Rochelle here are directly involved with language efforts, and your work kind of lies... not directly with language efforts, but within preservation and water resources and peyote. How do you experience the language in either in your work or in your personal life on a daily basis? Or maybe it's not daily.
Yeah, it's definitely not on a daily basis. My grandma, you know, she's affluent. Shoshone speaker. Her family comes from Winnemucca, Nevada. And so growing up, her and my grandfather spoke two different dialects of Shoshone. And so it was always really hard for us to understand, you know, what my grandma was saying versus what my grandfather was saying. And so it was kind of an interesting struggle, I guess. But in regards to ceremony and language, in dealing with the research that I did on peyote, it was, I would say that a majority of the people that I interviewed for my research, I would say probably 20% of them spoke a traditional language, but in talking with them, they would describe things to me in their traditional language, and of course, you know, translate that for me in English. But in regard to my research for that, language really was not a traditional language was really not a big part of it, which is really very sad. You know, for my own research here in Fort Hall, in dealing with, you know, my grandmother, you know, a lot of the things that she would say to me would be in Shoshone. During my interview with her, a lot of the things that she told me were in Shoshone, because sometimes when you're talking about things like religion or, you know, things in spiritual context, that's the only way you can relay things is by saying it in your language. And there are things that my grandmother would tell me in Shoshone that you can't really translate into English. And it's the same way in ceremony, you know, there's one word that you have that means the whole bunch of things all in one, you know, and you can't really explain what that one word is without, you know, writing a paragraph about what was just said in one word, you know. So I don't hear it as much as I would like to, And in regard to, you know, my program, where I'll be focusing on the camas lily, I'm hoping to be able to work with other tribes, because the camas lily grows right along the Columbia River Basin, and there's about 15 tribes, I believe, in this area. And so I'm assuming that I'm going to learn 15 different ways to say camas. At least that's what I'm hoping.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people, when you mention, so I teach a class that's American popular culture, and we do 1 week on Native Americans specifically, although I mention it throughout the semester. And most students, and this is my sampling from mainstream America, are really surprised that there's more than one Native American or indigenous language, right? I mean, it's surprising to them. Plus the different dialects, right, that exist within those.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's a whole other different, I mean, the dialects are, that's specifically sounds, right? That's the way you move your throat or your tongue. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So where do those all go? And that's really interesting to me when, Rochelle, when you talked about being in the archives and listening to old recordings, and then, and Dondi, you're talking about listening to your grandmother. How do those old recordings work? It's ironic because most of the old recordings were taken by anthropologists who believed that our languages were dying, right? And that was their kind of project, to use film and audio recording in this kind of anthropological way to record what would be dead soon. But now here we are, however many years later, utilizing those recordings to learn from them. And so what is that experience like? And I guess I would ask any of you how you use old recordings, and do you?
So, well, for example, for me in the archives, well, I guess I should say that I was going to school at UAF, and I was working, I'm an art major, you know, before anything, I'm an artist. So, but they were teaching the Gwich'in language there, and I jumped at the opportunity. And so I took the class as I was taking, you know, my Native Art Studio classes. And every semester I just kept taking the class. I was like very thirsty for the language, and I wanted to use that opportunity because it was there. So I took them, and I took all the classes that they had, and they had to actually start developing classes for me. And then it turned, so one of the classes they developed was a class in the archives where I would go up there, you know, and listen to recordings and listen to stories, and I would transcribe them into English. And so I was also working on my writing skills, you know, literacy, that kind of stuff. And then I would listen to them and hear the elders. And so for me, I know who that is. Like, that's those were my grandparents, and those were the grandparents of my friends and my ancestors. And so to me, I had that deep connection and that deep respect, you know, and it made me feel like more whole as a Gwich'in person. Like, I felt like I was gaining so much more than just hearing those sounds, and I felt like, you know, they were really guiding me in my education, and it was so much more than just sitting there listening to like a recording. You know, it was very fulfilling for me, and so to be able to access that was, you know, it was really great to have that there. And I'm glad that we did have all these anthropologists that went out into our communities, and a lot of them I still work with today. And we have a really great team at UAF, at the Alaska Native Language Center. And another great thing about the Alaska Native Language Archives is that they had just become all digital online, because you used to have to go in there and take the cassette tape and put it, you know, with the headphones and sit there. You had to go out up into the archives and actually be there physically. But now anyone can access them online. And they just have hundreds and hundreds of resources for any language in Alaska. you know, songs, music, like stories. There's so many good resources there.
Hmm. That sounds great. I'm really interested in archives myself, and so that sounds like a really, really awesome one. Dondi, do you... I know that one time you had tapes, right? And you, and you had sent these tapes to be... I don't remember, to be put on an MP3, right? Because you didn't have a tape player?
Yeah.
So I know that you use them. So why don't you talk a little bit about how you utilize archives? I mean, we can consider those archives and where you found them and what they are.
Actually, they were a part of a class. So at Idaho State, they actually teach Shoshone, and it was pretty controversial. Our tribe, they were really resistant. They didn't want non-Indians learning our language. And eventually, it was allowed. So we have a tribal member who is the instructor for the class. And they've created a Shoshone dictionary. They've created a Shoshone class. And they created these tapes, which we tried to get on to a MP3, and we also tried to get it on discs, and for whatever reason, it never worked. So they're still in their cassette tape form. And I no longer have a cassette player anywhere, so they don't get played. And it's really very sad on my part, you know, because it's like I was telling you before, you know, I find that I say more Shoshone things and Shoshone phrases and words when I'm around my grandparents or my grandma and my grandma's family. And it just kind of innately happens that way. And it was actually my daughter who pointed that out to me. And she tells me, you know, how come I don't talk that way at home? And I was like, you know, what are you talking about? And she says, oh, you were saying this and this in Shoshone. And I honestly didn't even realize that I was doing it. Hmm. It just kind of just came out, you know. And so I wish that I could speak more Shoshone. And, you know, being in Fort Hall and when I was working for the tribes, you hear the language with older groups. You don't hear the language so much with the younger, my generation, people. But what you are hearing now is more of slang Shoshone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really kind of an interesting language in itself. It's kind of like how the younger generation now are talking in like LOL and TGIF and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of what we say words like that in Shoshone. And I just call it slang Shoshone because that's the best way to describe it. It's an interesting form that the language has taken on because the language is very difficult. One of the guys who wrote the Shoshone dictionary, he told me that Shoshone, he's fluent in like 10 languages or something. And he told us that Shoshone was one of the hardest languages for him to learn. And so, you know, I say that myself and I'm a member, you know, it is difficult. Mm-hmm. It is difficult, but, yeah. So,
And this with the slang. So, as a comparison, do you think that your grandmother does that generation understand these new words, this slang, Shoshone, or no way?
I think they do. I think that they do because the word is still very much the original word. You know, like for instance, to say brain in Shoshone, you say goovish. You know, and so it's turned into goov, you know, you know, use your goov, you know,
use your goov.
You know, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It would be, it's acceptable. It's what you say. And it's just kind of funny how that's kind of evolved. And, you know, we have other words like that. Like, in Shoshone, you also say to say water, you say ba. And so when we were little, as kids, we learned the word water as bubba. Mm. And so even now, I find myself saying that, do you want some bubba, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's kind of ugly in comparison to ba, you know?
Right. Like, well, most slang is kind of ugly in comparison to its real form.
We do a lot of borrowing, you know, from one language into the other.
Oh, it can be like, for example.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it shut off. Yeah, we do a lot of borrowing, and especially, like, I was learning about village English, and village English, let's see, you know, example for, like, Ebonics, you know how that's, you're speaking English, but it's, like, another, it's basically another language with, it has its own, like, rules, and there's a rhyme and a reason to how, you know, you're speaking. So actually, that's how village English is. It's kind of like, it's the in-between for the ancestral language and English. And so It's really interesting how village English dialects change throughout the state, because, and we did a study on that in my program, looking at, like, Yuchtin, the Yupik speakers, you know, how they, the way they speak in the village, and then compared to, like, Gwich'in or Otna or Dena'ina speakers, how they speak in their own villages. So it's really cool to see how a lot of those phonetics within the language change over into English. So for example, like in Gwich'in, like, you know, like tag questions, you know how you say a tag question is like you're kind of asking for reaffirmation, or, you know, do you agree with me? I mean, so in Gwich'in, we would say, like, for example, let's go to the store, okay? You know, something like that, like, like we're saying, like, right, you want to? You want to do that? And so, so in English, we'll say, let's go to the store, huh? You know, huh? Like, it doesn't really sound like anything, but if you actually pick it apart linguistically and look at it, it's directly related to the tag question in Gwich'in. And so, like, in with Yupik communities, instead of saying huh, they say their tag question in Yuchtin is ga. It's like, I can't really say those sounds, but it's ga. And their tag question, they say yeah. And so it's like the same phonetics. And we looked at other examples too. And it's just, you know, looking at something small like that, you learn a lot from how the languages have, like, evolved. Even though we're not still speaking our ancestral languages, we still use those phonetics, and our tongues still make the same sounds. And so it's just really interesting to see, because, you know, across the state of Alaska, we have 20 different languages, you know, and just in the Athabascan languages, we have, you know, the 11 different groups. And among those, there's all our different dialects. So even just within, like, the Gwich'in Nation, there is so many different dialects from Arctic Village to Fort Yukon, you know, just amongst the Alaska side. And then there's the Canadian side. So, and that's also another challenge.
So Rachel, what you use technology a lot in these similar ways. So you're listening a lot, not only to the Navajo language, but to other languages from all over the U.S. Are there things that non-native people assume or presume or ask you about language in your work?
Well, a couple of times when I've come across non-native people who are not too familiar with, you know, the different types of languages that are out there, okay, they approach me and they say, "How?"
Oh,
which is,
goodness.
Yeah, which is really funny, because it's
gosh.
Like, okay. So you know, there's that type of approach. And I'm teaching a class now that is Chicano focused. It's a film class, and my background is in film, so we look a lot at film aesthetics. The majority of the class is Spanish, or Hispanic, Latino, Latinas. I'm also learning that terminology as well. And one of the things that they have asked was if I spoke Spanish, and I think their immediate assumption was that I was a Latino.
And
Latina, that's right. And I did say that I'm not.
Or maybe they did think you're a Latino. I don't know.
I am Native American. So they said, you know,
is there one type of Native person? And I said, no, there's several hundred types of Native people. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to know if we spoke all one language. And I said, no, actually, we have hundreds of different types of languages, which was, you know, just some of the questions that they asked. And then the other thing was, one thing that they were really curious about was if we had a written language as well. I think the bigger question that really stood out to me amongst those questions was, how are we losing language speakers?
Right.
Because again, they come from a background where they're, you know, they speak Spanish in the home, outside of home, they read, they write it. So their concern was, well, how are you guys losing your language?
Right. Right. And that's a good question. So I'm going to ask you that, and then someone else can add on to that. But so how are you losing? How do you answer that? So there's the issue of colonization, which is how Native Americans, Alaskan Natives, Canadian, right across the board, lost their language, which is another story. And if someone can come up with a great one sentence on that, that history, great. But how are you losing your language? Do you see Navajo languages being lost? Are these sounds being lost now? And if so, how? How do you see them being lost? How, when you're at home and you're in your community, in the Navajo Nation, how do you see, even in Navajo with language all around you, I mean, Navajo, you can go to Burger King and order in Navajo. You can go to the bank, to a Wells Fargo, and everybody's speaking in Navajo. You go to the basketball game and the whole game is being announced in Navajo. So as an Ojibwe speaker, learner, I think I'm always so impressed and amazed that we can go into Burger King and order a Whopper in Navajo, right? So how, with all that around you, how are you losing it?
Well, I think there's an outsider perspective and there's an insider perspective.
Okay.
And I can come from the insider perspective and say that within my family, my immediate family, there's myself, my daughter, I have an 18-year-old brother who thinks he knows everything, and my father, and of course my aunts and my uncles, who are all fluent speakers of the Navajo language. But as you know, there's a certain generation, which I think we fall into the generation of where we're hearers of the language, but we don't speak it. And so that affects our transmission to our children.
Okay. And how about your community? Not that you can speak for your whole community, but in your personal experience, Don, with the language and the sounds now, how is the status, do you think, from your experience of the Shoshone language, and how is it being lost?
I think it still has to do with that stigma of shame that goes along with being Native American. Mm-hmm. In our community, we have a immersion school now that has been open for maybe 2 years, and it already is having issues. I mean, it had issues from the get-go, because we had, you know, individuals in our community who weren't really very supportive of it. I mean, it eventually passed, and they got some buildings, and they have students. But even within the school system, there's still a lot of fighting about who can teach what, if they're teaching the language properly, if they're saying the words the correct way. I mean, there's a lot of language pettiness is the best way to say it. Because, you know, as we've been talking about, everyone knows of the dialects and the various dialects that occur. I mean, as I shared with you before, my grandfather and my grandmother spoke different dialects, even in our own home, you know, and so they both said things completely different and meant the same thing, but they said it differently. And so there's a lot of that kind of bickering that occurs at the school, where individuals are not happy with the teacher and they don't like the way the teacher's teaching these children. They don't like that they're teaching them songs, or they're teaching them, you know, certain aspects of the culture, which to me is ridiculous. You know, because that's the reason they're in this immersion school.
Right.
And, you know, the language is always evolving. The language is, it's not a static language, you know, or maybe it is. But it's definitely not stagnant.
Right.
And so there needs to be, I guess, just some compromise in how these kids are going to learn the traditional language. Because we've all become very westernized. We're beyond colonized now, you know. My mother is a fluent speaker, but she doesn't speak fluently all the time. She can have conversations with elders. She can have conversations with some people of her age fluently in Shoshone. My aunt can also speak fluent. My uncles, they cannot. And so even though we all grew up in the same household, which is very strange.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because my grandfather, he had told us when we were little, you know, that if we wanted to talk to him, we had better learn Shoshone. And so that's what we had to do. You know, we had to learn to listen and keep our mouth shut. And, so, you know, the best way I can answer your question is, it's just the changing of the times, I guess. And it's really, you know, how much effort we want to put into saving our language and becoming fluent speakers and becoming fully immersed.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree with that. And with the immersion schools, there's two things that maybe go on in what you're talking about and in some of my experiences working with other tribes, not my own, is this idea of ownership and who owns these sounds. And I don't see so much of that going on in my community, but I have seen it in others, particularly with the youth. For example, you might have one family who has really fluent speakers, and then they're in charge of kind of teaching the language. And they kind of act as gatekeepers of who they're going to teach these sounds to. Right. And that's not very productive.
Right.
By any means. And then the other thing is funding. Right. So it's hard to fund these immersion schools. Right. And in the conversations that I've heard, and Rochelle would probably know more and Rachel about this, but it's not, at least in the lower 48, doesn't seem to be on the highest priority of many tribes. How about in Alaska, Rochelle, are the immersion schools being funded and are they being supported by the community at large?
Yeah, so I'm excited to say that we've been gaining a lot of support and there's a lot of momentum happening for language revitalization, especially with the bill that was passed last, was it October? So all of our languages are the official languages of the state. And I think behind Hawaii, I'm not sure which other states actually have that for the indigenous languages. And so now there's another bill, and I've actually been helping to draft it, and it's for supporting immersion within charter schools. So that's really good. And then that also creates like an opportunity for more funding. But I do know that it's always tough with finding funding, and there's always a lot of competition between tribes, you know, so that kind of puts tribes against, you know, each other for their projects and stuff. So, I mean, at the same time, we can all learn from each other, but, you know, as far as funding, we're kind of all grabbing for the same, you know, funds that they put out there for us.
So to wrap it up, I'm gonna ask each of you kind of, so the in thinking about everything that we just talked about, what does it all mean to you, right? So what does language mean to you? Not language in general, but your language, right? What does the Shoshone language mean to you, and what does it feel like when you hear a sound, or when you do find a tape recorder, right, and you can hear these old sounds, or when your grandparents say a word, or you're in a ceremony where you hear a new word, what does it feel like? And since I use Shoshone as my example, I'm going to ask you that question, Dawn.
You know, it feels good. It feels really good. It's like I was telling you before, you know, I find that I innately say some of these words when I'm with my family or near my grandma, or, you know, not necessarily in my own home, but in my grandma's home, you know, that's a lot more. I don't know. I find that really strange. But it makes me feel good. And it makes me feel good when I'm in a ceremony and I hear these certain words, you know, because I know that some of those words are words of desperation. And you know, some of those prayers are ancient prayers, you know. And so it makes me feel good to be a part of the ceremony and understanding the language. That feels really good. It feels like home. It feels, it makes me feel like I have that connection to not only my grandma, but to my grandma's mother and my great grandmother's mother, mm-hmm. you know, cause these are all the same words that have been shared with them for generations. And so I've learned them and I try to teach my daughter that, you know, cause my daughter is also Onondaga and Mohawk and I know very little of, that language and very little of the culture. And so, you know, she has that struggle as well, but, it definitely makes me feel like, I'm a part of something.
Right. I definitely agree with that. Just hearing new words or hearing sounds. And a lot of them lately I've been learning from film, like this word called Nawagijagon, which I didn't know what it meant. And then I asked my family members who are really involved in language. They didn't know what it meant. And we really had to do some researching, which was kind of fun, and found out that it's a huge word and it's so old. And it means really huge things, you know, essentially kind of the center of, I guess in English you might say something like the center of everything or the center of what people might call heaven, or, you know what I mean? This, it's hard to explain it in English and you kind of have to feel the sound to understand mm-hmm. it. And that to me is really fulfilling and makes me feel like I'm a part of something much larger than myself. Mm-hmm. Okay, Rachel, what does it mean to you?
What does my language mean to me?
Yeah, just what does it feel like? What does it mean to you? I mean, it obviously has a great impact on your life because you involve it in the things that you do. What does it mean to you?
It means, I feel that it's like home.
Yeah.
You know, being away from the reservation and I think language is one thing that I can carry with me and it just feels like it's home. For example, I met a woman, I'd say a couple weeks ago, and I often see her, at school, and I've always wondered if she was Navajo because she has very Navajo features. So
that's a whole other show.
One evening I just got up the courage and I asked her, I said, "Are you Navajo?" And she smiled and she said, "Yes, I am." An older Navajo woman. So again, my assumption was that she spoke Navajo. So I asked her where she was from in Navajo, you know, Hade Naga. And she said, "I don't speak Navajo." And for a few seconds, I felt a little sad because I really wanted to hear Navajo. That was my connection to home. But at the same time, she said, you know, my mother was my family and I were relocated here to Sacramento. So I grew up here in Sacramento. Mm. So she said, I guess I would say I'm from Flagstaff. And it was nice, again, to meet a new person. And I'm always interested in people's stories and their narratives. But for, you know, for a while there, I was sad that I wasn't able to hear it or I didn't get to engage or have a conversation in Navajo. Because, again, that's my connection to home. So right. It's very important that that I continue to speak it, that I continue to learn it, and that, you know, that it gets passed on.
Yeah. And, Rochelle, how about yourself?
So it's kind of difficult to sum up what my language means to me, because that's kind of like, what does it mean to be Native, or how do you define that? Mm-hmm. How can I express that with just words, you know, right now? And so, but just thinking about, you know, thinking about it, it's to me, as I learn, well, I guess I should share that as I learned, you know, more in the language, I started having dreams about my grandparents, my grandfather, who he passed away when I was about 8 years old. I started having dreams about him, and I would speak to him in the Gwich'in language. And I would understand him, and I would speak fluently, and I would have like no apprehension or no, I was confident, a confident speaker. And to me, that's kind of like a good description of how I feel as a speaker and as a learner and as a teacher of my language. I feel connected to my people, and I feel like it makes me complete, you know, like a whole person, where I don't have that void or that wanting or that wishing that I could understand. And as my learning progresses, I feel like, I don't want to say that I'm fluent, but I'm proficient. And a lot of us are trying to move away from using that word fluent. What is it? You know, I'm never going to be fluent, but I'm proficient. And as I learn more with the language, I feel like I'm opening more windows into our culture. And our language is like the direct, you know, it's evolved over so much time and so many, you know, it's like our intimate relationship with our environment and our land and our animals. And so when I learn things in the language, I feel like I'm learning about the environment, or there's just so much knowledge. I it's hard to even explain right now, but so there's so much meaning, so much knowledge in the language. So for me, it's like I'm keeping that door open for myself and then for also my kids. And, you know, and I feel like I'm remembering the language because I know it's inside of me. And so I'm remembering who I am and, you know, just keeping that alive within myself and, you know, for future generations.
Well, all three of you, certainly as a filmmaker and a sound artist myself, I certainly am inspired by the three of you who do the kinds of work that you're doing, particularly for Native communities. And the fact that you're all women and mothers is very encouraging and inspiring. And so I thank you for your time, and thank you for joining the conversation today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Miigwech.
Miigwech. Don't forget to use your guive.
Goo.
Oh, there you go. Use your guive. There's the slang on your slang.
Slang, yeah. On the slang. Hot, that's done. Good.
Use your guive. We didn't even get into the nasty words.
No.
That's for After Dark.
After Dark.
That's when my voice changes, too.
Well, it was
good stuff.
Yeah, it was really nice to speak to both Don and Rochelle, yeah, and have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And thank you, Marcella, for putting this together. Mm-hmm. I really look forward to, you know, working with all of you in the future.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. I can't.